morning. I'm Christina Lanier, one of the co-directors of the National Treatment Court Resource Center. Along with me is Kristen Duvall, the other co-director of the center.
Hello.
We are excited to bring you another episode of our series looking at roles in treatment courts. Today, we're going to focus on the role of treatment court alumni and peer recovery support specialist. We have two experts in this area today, Carlos Gonzalez and Michael Moradian. Before we get started, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our guests. Carlos is a graduate of the First Judicial District Adult Drug Court in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He graduated in 2001. He's maintained a long-term recovery and has been an alumni leader in New Mexico for 22 years. He's currently the statewide program manager for the Administrative Office of the Courts in New Mexico, in charge of alumni and peer initiatives. He's also a licensed adult drug and alcohol counselor and a certified peer support worker.
Michael Moradian is a person in long-term recovery and a 2003 graduate of the Anchorage, Alaska Felony Drug Court. He is a co-founder of the Alaska Therapeutic Court Alumni Group and a co-founder of the National Treatment Court Alumni Association. He is certified by the state of Alaska as a Peer Support Professional 3 and is an Alaska State Certified Chemical Dependency Clinical Supervisor. Michael has provided alumni peer support and clinical treatment services for over 20 years. Welcome, Carlos and Michael.
Well, thank you so much for allowing us to be here. It's an honor.
Yes, thank you for having us.
So we're really excited to complete the episode today because of sort of the movement within the field, within the area of peer support. We hear from programs all the time about, you know, incorporating the peer voice and that peer role on their teams. So can we start with kind of an overview of the role and really defining the role of a peer, alumni, peer support? Kind of what does that continuum look like? And what are some of the responsibilities associated with those various roles?
Sure, well, I'll jump in. So when we identify the roles, that's always been a strange concept as we move through the process of certified peers, right? Mm-hmm. Because everybody uses the term peer, we're talking about generally certified peers in those roles, whether it be in a treatment court, whether it be in an agency, a community agency, a community resource agency. So when we talk about the term peer, we're talking about a quality of purpose in recovery. So an alumni graduating a program, that person is not a certified peer yet, may become, but they may not be yet. However, when they engage with participants of a program to help that continuum of care, they have a quality of purpose, that purpose being long-term recovery and finding recovery paths and seeking their recovery path and developing their recovery path and recovery strategies. In my experience and what I do in the state of New Mexico and what I've done in my 22 years of recovery is that the roles and responsibilities of an alumni and a certified peer are similar in the sense that we guide people to resources, we help people find their own recovery capital and develop more recovery capital for long-term recovery. But ultimately, in both roles, we land up serving our community in a very positive and amazing way with our lived experience.
Yeah, I agree with Carlos. And also, I think it is important to make those distinctions, even though both have lived experience and both are peers. Making that distinction between alumni and certified peers is very important because the roles, responsibilities are different. And also there's other considerations. If you are a peer support specialist or you're a certified peer, then generally you're working for the court and you're most likely in a paid position. And so therefore you have different ethical responsibilities. And you also have more access usually to, say, peer records and things like that. So you also have a lot more responsibility in terms of ethics and confidentiality and those types of things. Also, alumni can serve many roles in a volunteer capacity that may fulfill some of the duties that a certified peer might fulfill, but they, again, probably won't have the same restrictions or the same regulations that they need to follow If they're in a volunteer position, they won't have access to records and things like that. Also, one of the benefits of peers being involved in the courts is that they have the lived experience of actually going through the program to which they are supporting. And so they have that, usually they have a much better relationship with the participants that they support and the fellow graduates that they support and work with, because they have that shared experience.
So when we're talking about just shifting to alumni specifically, and I will mention that we're going to have a second podcast on how to start an alumni group. So if you haven't listened to that one yet, you can listen to that one after you listen to this one. But one of the things that comes up is just, how do you get alumni engaged, and perhaps outside of just developing an alumni group? So any ideas that you all have around how to get alumni engaged from the beginning, I guess?
Well, I think there'll definitely be more in that other podcast about that. But I will say this, in New Mexico, my experience, and actually some of the states I've worked with in starting alumni groups, one of the things we start talking about is starting with the end in mind. So when someone comes into the program, we always want, as program coordinators, as judges, as teams, we should be developing that individual, knowing that their lived experience is valuable, mm-hmm. rather than see them live in the shame of their past, mm-hmm. recognizing that their past actually serves a great purpose for their future and the future of others by sharing that lived experience. So starting with the end in mind, how we keep them engaged here in New Mexico, and the way I've shared with other people in other states, is throughout the program, you will find that there are people that really want to give of themselves. They want to help other people, and they might not be quite ready in phase one, sometimes not even phase two, but when they're getting through phase two, getting to phase three, you're going to see that there's people that really have this natural want to serve somebody else, to help somebody else get through the program when they're first coming in or they're struggling with certain things. And so that's how you kind of start developing them, to realize that, hey, there's a role for you, because when you graduate this program, you can help mentor other people, mm-hmm. just by your lived experience. Michael said it earlier, and one of the things that we have to recognize is this is a volunteer thing. So they've got to feel it, right? Mm-hmm. They've got to feel it. And it doesn't fit everybody. Not everybody is an extrovert. That is respected 100%. But a lot of times you find folks that realize they really are feeling the need to share what they know about the program. So that's where it kind of starts, is that, and I say this with respect, that singular purpose of accomplishing the program, and how are we going to do that? Because it doesn't look like I'm going to be able to when I walk in the door. Mm-hmm. When you have an alumni or folks in phase three, phase four, phase five, when you have those folks saying, hey, I know exactly how you feel, and here's how I got through phase one, and here's some suggestions, that's how you start getting people excited and engaged in the fact that, hey, there's a role for you to do this on a regular basis if you so choose.
It's absolutely true. And what I would dovetail that with is, so for Alaska Court, one of the things that our treatment provider did from the beginning is when someone new came in, they would assign them somebody who was in a later phase, mm-hmm. to help guide them, mm-hmm. through the program. And that started right away with building that relationship with helping those that are coming behind us. Even though it was 3 years after I graduated that we started our alumni, that was already built into the program. So people got used to the idea of helping those that were coming from behind. And then also people that had completed the program, one of the reasons why we started the alumni program is we recognized those people that Carlos was talking about that really was grateful for the court, grateful for the program. They found something in there that they felt was of great price, great value. And so they wanted to give it away. So they would just show up to like graduations, and they would show up to court, and the judges would start recognizing them. So if you're going to start something like that, that's the one thing that I would start right away, is just inviting those that have completed to come back and show current participants that it works and people are still maintaining sobriety after the program. And that was what really helped us. Even when we went back, when we started 3 years after I graduated, we went back and contacted people that had completed the course years before. The reason we got buy-in was because they felt that, one, the court helped them save their lives, and also that they had that memory of, hey, when I came into the court, someone was there to help guide me through. And so I could see myself doing that as well. Mm-hmm. Also, never underestimate the power of free food and having things like sober activities of picnics and holiday celebrations.
Yeah,
right. I was just going to say, thinking about, you know, programs that may struggle with keeping folks engaged early on, right? A lot of times we hear from participants that it's overwhelming. You know, the program has a lot of responsibilities and a lot of requirements. And so that peer voice, connecting them with new participants early on, I imagine can be really helpful in getting and keeping folks engaged early on in the program.
When you think about a structure, you think about, you have the participant, and then maybe they fill a mentor role, and then they become an alumni, right? That kind of natural progression. And then the progression after alumni, they may decide to become a certified peer. Then they might decide to become a therapist, mm-hmm. right? Because it's just a natural progression of where they feel they want to put their energy. But I got to tell you, holiday celebrations, that has been the gold for us here in New Mexico. When I started in 2001, that's how I started. I started with getting the alumni together after I graduated and having Thanksgiving in court, mm-hmm. you know, for court the week before Thanksgiving, having Christmas the week before Christmas, had them bring their families and their kids and tons of food, presents, all that stuff. It made a difference for the participants to see that we actually valued that. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you this, and the reason that is, since we started with that question about alumni back in 2001, we didn't have an organized alumni group in the First Judicial District Court here in Santa Fe. What we did have was a group of alumni that showed up to court every week. They weren't organized, They showed up every single week. And every single week, the judge honored those alumni. At the beginning of court, as soon as he convened court, he had them stand up, introduce themselves to the participants. He clapped for them and he pointed at them and told the participants, if you have any questions on how to get through this program, ask them. Mm-hmm. And we did.
Right.
So I tell you, as a person in long-term recovery, and 100% I stand foundational to tell you, had those alumni not been there to share that experience with me, I don't believe I would be here in front of you today, because I had no hope that mm-hmm. I would be able to make that program work. They're the ones that gave me the hope. As you said, they told me that this is how we do it. This is how we did it. Here's some suggestions. But here's the other thing I realized. And then I'll stop here. The thing is this, when a participant's sitting in front of a team member, a treatment court coordinator, a therapist, the case manager, whatever it is, the judge, and you're telling them, you're going to be able to do this. This is not, you're going to be able to handle all of this. You'll be successful. You have to tell them that, and they know that. Mm-hmm. When an alumni tells them that, or someone who's in phase three, phase four, phase five, it carries a different credence mm-hmm. because they're actually in it.
Right.
So just want to throw that out there.
So that's really great. Yeah, those engagement ideas with alumni are very helpful. And I think, you know, having them in court, some of the courts that we've worked with, they're not there. And I think we've said to each other very often, like, it would be great if somebody that had been through the program was here. So that's a great idea to give people a way to get them started in their engagement. So sort of, again, shifting gears to peer recovery support specialist or peers, peer recovery, they're called all sorts of things. But there's been a lot of discussion lately as to the roles of peer recovery support specialist in treatment courts. So should they be outside of the court? Should they be employed by the court? What's their role when it comes to participants? And, you know, if somebody is confiding in a peer recovery support specialist, should they share that information? So really, detailing their role in a treatment court as a peer recovery support specialist. So I didn't know if you all could talk to that a little bit, given all of your experience with that area.
Well, what I can tell you is we are going down that road right now in New Mexico. And as we develop a process for this, we have learned a lot of things. And a lot of them we've learned by not just people asking questions, but people like me and Michael who bring up points that nobody thought about. And so what I'll share with you is when we talk about a certified peer recovery specialist, peer recovery support specialist, whatever the title is, if they're licensed by a state, they carry a different level of responsibility. And Michael mentioned a little bit before about this, and he knows a lot about this from Alaska, and I'm glad he's going to ducktail off this. What we've learned in New Mexico is we have our own certification program with our with an agency separate from the court that certifies peers to be certified peer support workers, CPSWs, here in New Mexico. And all the requirements that go with that allows them to work with agencies or be integrated into the courts or into a treatment court team, whether they work for an agency as part of the treatment court team or they work for the court itself. Here's what we're finding out and have found out. Because of that licensure, they're going to have access to client records, whether those are whatever type of records, it could be medical, therapy, the resources that they're receiving, all of those things that they have access to. It gives them a responsibility that if stuff is shared directly with that certified peer support worker, they have an ethical responsibility to report it. Right? If they've signed a release of information as part of the team to the court and they're working as a team member in the court, there's things you have to share. Now, similar to a therapist, there's things you don't have to share. However, what we're learning is as we train certified peers to work in the courts and work in the treatment court teams, is training them on how to relay the message so that you get the message across about progress individuals making or lack thereof, and how to get that messaging to the team so that they can appropriately assess what needs to happen next as a team for that individual to help them get better or get even better. So for example, I'm not gonna tell you that they've told me about a specific trauma that happened to them. What I'm gonna say to you is, a trauma situation came up in our session. I referred them to the therapist to make an appointment, which they did. And they now have a plan to work through that process. I never divulged what that trauma was because I shouldn't do that. But I did make sure the team knows that, hey, here's this trauma. So you may see some behavior that is conducive with dealing with a trauma or working through that process. That might make you wonder what's going on with them. But now you know that might, that probably is it or might be it. Work with a therapist to make sure they're working through it. So that's one thing we found out. The other thing is this: getting a certified peer on the team, whether it be in the court or through an agency, is really important because what we're finding in New Mexico is the team members, the coordinator, the probation officer, the surveillance officer, all these folks, even the therapist, they don't have the bandwidth to connect to resources when people know they need resources. They do their best. They hand them a list. Here's a list of folks that I've heard of in the city or in the state or in the community or in the region. A peer specialist, a certified peer specialist, is trained to do that. Like, I'm going to sit down and assess with you what type of resources you might need, and I'm going to direct you to those resources and get you there. And that's one of the things that we found. And so we're integrating peers into our courts and our treatment courts in New Mexico. And as a paid employee of the courts, you're now supported by the courts to help do those things and to make those decisions and help clients get better, not only in treatment courts, before they get to treatment court. So if they're meeting with a peer post-adjudication, pre-adjudication, you're already meeting them up, even if it's pretrial services, you're meeting them up with resources they need. So when they get to the treatment court, they're already getting services and you just continue those services.
That's great. So it sounds like the peer support really serving in that capacity of connecting individuals with resources in the community, being, you know, kind of another set of ears and for maybe a program case manager or a probation officer, but really serving in that supportive role for the participant and in making those connections and following up.
It is. And let me just finish with this. I got to tell you, when you get a certified peer support worker or a peer, or I know we're not talking about this right now, or an alumni to have input, not make decisions, but have input on the team, it helps the team to understand that maybe the decision they're making for a sanction or incentive, and I don't like that term any more than anybody else, but the term sanction or incentive, creating a therapeutic response model, mm-hmm. when you get it from a place of lived experience, it gives you a different thought process. When you haven't thought that way, for example, you might have someone that says, Michael is responding negatively to treatment or is responding negatively to compliance with the program. We've tried everything, but he doesn't seem to be focused. Well, a peer may say, hey, you know, I know that Michael is really engaged in 12-step recovery. So maybe consider having him attend daily meetings for a couple of weeks. Maybe that'll help him get refocused because it's something he actually puts his energy into. It might be helpful. Mm-hmm. Well, we might not have thought of that, right, as a team, because that's not the front of our thought process. But someone who has that lived experience and has worked with Michael can be able to say, here's something I know Michael really has belief in, it might be helpful for
him. Yeah, absolutely. And so what we've discovered in Alaska too, and one of the things that we were very honored to be a part of, the Alaska Therapeutic Corps alumni, was when Alaska decided to create a certification for peer support workers, we were invited to write the curriculum for the 40-hour training that would be required for that certification. So we really geared ours towards getting peers to work in the courts. We really see the value of that, mm-hmm. even if they're not alumni, although it is a path for alumni to become paid workers in the courts, which we also find a value for. Having someone with that lived experience be able to look through the lens of what it's like to be in recovery, struggle through the court program, or even just struggle through recovery if you're not alumni, excuse me. A lot of times, court programs don't have staff that are in recovery. And so you need that perspective in order to give a circumspect view of the person and what their struggles are and how they can be successful in the program. Carlos gave a great example in terms of how they might be able to help in supporting making decisions for a person that may be struggling through the program. And also that connect through the resources. But one of the things that I want also touch on is that it's difficult sometimes to pinpoint what the role of a peer is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's easier by saying what they're not, right? Mm-hmm. So they're not a counselor. They're not a case manager, although they may connect people to resources. Mm-hmm. But really the value of that is usually they've used those resources themselves and they can help actually navigate. Instead of just saying, here's the address and phone number, they can say, hey, talk to Billy because Billy's really the greatest person. You know, connect with him at that organization because he's really going to help you. And they're not sponsors, right? Mm-hmm. They're a guide that can walk alongside the person and help them when they're struggling in their recovery because they're still, it's that new path. And so someone who's walked that path already can tell them where the potholes are and where the stumbling blocks are. And also, you know, where the best coffee shops are on that path, right? Where the best resources, where the best ways to cope with the struggles are. And so really that when I talk to people in courts about peers, it's really kind of helping them identify because courts are always struggling with budgets and staffing and funding, as you talked about. And so a lot of times peers are being asked to do things that are outside of their role. And I really want to touch on this because this is so very important because first of all, you lose the value right away of having the peer. Mm-hmm. Once you move them out of their role, you've lost the value of having a peer because now they're doing groups, or they're doing notes, or they're doing transportation, or whatever it is that, that they're doing. And so you're giving them responsibility, which you wouldn't have a therapist do, because it ruins that therapeutic relationship. Well, you don't want to have a peer do that, because that ruins the peer relationship, that ability to guide them. And also, I really like the way that Carlos talked about the fact that they are certified. They do need to share information, but we do train them on how to share that information so that it doesn't undermine the credibility of the peer. Right. So they don't, they're not, one of the values of the peer is that you will get information as a peer that a clinician would die for. Right. I mean, they would kill for the information because of the relationship. When you meet with a peer, it's not that, okay, I'm in my therapist's office, I know this is being recorded, they got to write it down, they're going to be recommending treatment recommendations and all. So with a peer, it's so much more relaxed and so much more organic that you get information that is very, very valuable. And so we teach our peers how to work with that information in honoring that relationship and not undermining the credibility of the peer role in helping that person, but also having that very valuable lens that they look at, that they can share with the court team and give them insight that they wouldn't otherwise have.
Right.
I definitely want to jump on and say something else about this. I think this is really important for the audience to hear. What I have run into, not just in New Mexico, but other places I've gone, similar to Michael, is that the judge, the DA, the public defender, they have this thought process around legalities, right? Mm-hmm. And I respect their roles, but I think they still have a misunderstanding sometimes about that role of that peer. And even if the peer is working for the court, it's this obligatory information sharing they feel like they should be happening, that what they don't realize is that once the peer loses the trust of the participant, that trust is gone and it does not come back. And that mistrust is organic. So as I lose the trust of Michael, Michael's going to make sure that everybody else knows. Right. Hey, be careful what you tell Carlos, because he's going to tell the judge.
Yeah, right.
Right. So understanding that. So not only do peers need to be trained, teams need to be trained. Mm-hmm. Teams need to be trained to understand those roles, just as Michael so eloquently put it, right? To really understand that. Because here's what we want the teams to know, everybody out there in the audience and everybody that's willing to listen to this. Bottom line is, alumni and peers, our biggest focus is to empower people to advocate for themselves. So when they tell us of a need or a trauma or something that's happening, we are telling them and empowering them to go to the program for help, to trust the program. We're not going to go tell the program for them. We're telling them, you can trust that individual. Go speak to them. And when they hear that from alumni or peers, they're probably more likely to trust that person's going to hear them and help them. Mm-hmm. And so it's really about trust, connection, and empowering folks, not, hey, I've got this information, you have information, and I want you to share it with us because you have a obligation as a court employee. Mm-hmm. Yeah, threats don't work, but I'm going to tell you what I can tell you, but I'm hoping that that individual tells you for themselves. The last thing is, here in New Mexico, because of that whole point that I just made, we've created a forensic credential. It's not quite done yet, but our Office of Peer Recovery and Engagement that certifies our peers, in order to work in the courts or in the treatment court, we are creating a forensic credential. And that forensic credential is kind of like a judicial 101. How to navigate the judicial system as a peer, and also how to navigate treatment courts, right? Because some of the certified peers that come in may not have been through a treatment court, but we certainly want them to understand that process because they're still a peer. They still have that lived experience that's going to be extremely helpful. Mm-hmm. So just thinking about that training around folks coming into the court system, I don't think it's a smart idea just to let them come right in, integrate them into the system without that understanding, because what if they don't have extensive justice involvement? Right. How are they going to adequately serve that other peer, that person coming through the the adjudication process and navigating that also in the treatment court, same process. So.
Yeah, this is so timely. So Kristen and I did some research with some colleagues recently, and you know, you're hitting the nail on the head when we asked courts that had a peer, are the roles outlined in your operations manual for the peer? And the vast majority said no. So going back to that, educating the other members of the team, if it's not written down as far as at least what the role of the peer support is, then how can you expect the other team members to know what their role is? So you have to, like you said, you have to educate the other team members. And from what we've experienced, and I'm sure you all have too, is the expectations of peers tend to be much higher than they should be in the court, in the treatment court. So perhaps, like, for example, one court, you know, the peer basically transported people. That's what they did. Transportation, which can be an important component, but it really felt like they were losing that, like you said, losing that peer component, being able to be that person. And relatedly, we also asked about having a say or commenting on decisions regarding, like you said, sanctions and incentives, case management issues, all of these things. And the vast majority, over 80% of the respondents that had a peer, the peers had input on the decisions of all of those things related to treatment courts. So it's again, like you said, it's sort of an evolving conversation to have, is what is the role of the peer? And again, we're talking more specifically about treatment courts here, but what is that role? Oh, we also asked, did they have training before they became a peer? So made me think of that when you're talking about those that maybe didn't go through treatment court. Did they get trained on treatment court models and that type of thing before they became a peer? And the vast majority, you know, it was no. So I think we have a lot of space here to provide guidance when it comes to the utilization of these very important persons in the treatment court process.
Yeah.
And absolutely.
I was going to say,
wanted to affirm what you were saying. Yeah, absolutely. So it's a two-way street. So teams need to learn who peers are and what they do and what their roles are. And peers need to know what courts do and how they run and what the process is if they haven't been through a court. Absolutely. I was trying to think of a good analogy, but I think it's just easily understood that if you put somebody into an unknown environment and expect them to thrive, they're not going to. So they need to have some idea of not only what it means to be a peer, but what does it mean to be a peer in a court?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
How does that role fit into the continuum of care in a court? And what things do I need to be aware of that I wouldn't need to be aware of if I just went to go work for a treatment provider, mm-hmm. right? It's a different environment. It's a different culture. And there's different processes and there's different things that I need to be aware of so that I can navigate that and be the best peer that I can be. And one of the things I don't want to go backwards, but I want to touch just briefly again on what Carlos was saying is one of the things that is very valuable about the peers, more so I think about alumni, we'll talk about that in the next session, is that they really are an advocate for the program. They really are an advocate. They can be an ally for the program, and building that trust and credibility between your participants and the treatment. Like Carlos said before, when you have someone with lived experience promote something or explain the value of the team, it's going to carry a lot more weight than just the treatment team or the provider saying, yeah, you can trust us and we're mm-hmm. here for you, because the relationship prior to that, this was something that was very powerful in my treatment court experience, was that every other experience I had with the court was punitive.
Right.
So I always had to be on guard and I always had to protect myself. And it wasn't until I was in that final phase that I finally started to believe that, okay, these people are for me. Mm-hmm. They really are. You know, when I saw the judge come out to our softball games and have hot dogs with us, right? Mm-hmm. And they asked me when I went up before the judge every week, and the judge asked me, so how's your wife? How's your kids? You know, the first couple of times I was like, well, why do you want to know?
Right.
But afterwards, I realized that they really do care. Mm-hmm. And a lot, I'm sure you've heard this phrase before, that people really won't care about what you say until they know how much you care.
Right.
Right. So the a peer or an alumni can really be a fantastic bridge to close that gap between that that understanding that the court really is there for me and not against me. So I just wanted to touch on that. Thank you for letting me do that.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I know we could talk on this forever, but I think it's really important that we spend some time on this, because we out in this audience, there could be judges, DAs, public defenders, all these roles. And one of the things that I have 100% ran into this wall in New Mexico and in other states, and not all at the same time, but it's a dismissive attitude of a peer on the team, because they're not as much as a professional or as much of a professional. They're not as knowledgeable. They're not as educated. All of those thought processes, respectfully understanding those. I get it. But here's the thing. When we talk about the term peer, it's a quality of purpose. So if that peer's purpose on that team is to make sure that the absolute best thing happens for that participant, that should be your purpose as well, right? Right. So if we all have the same quality of purpose, we all have the same, it's equality of purpose. If we all have that same ideal, then we should all be listening to everybody's knowledge base about how to come up with that final decision. But to all you judges out there in the audience, with all due respect, you lead the way. And when you recognize that there's not an equality of purpose, a peer representation of everybody being a peer at the table at a staffing, you need to call that out and find a way to correct that. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I have had, as a peer, before I had my license as a treatment provider, when I was sitting at the table and they were asking me as an alumni and a peer, and I was a peer and a mentor, they were asking me, so we would like to your thoughts on how we might better respond to this person. And this was back in the sanction grid days. You've got to remember that back in the early 2000s, they were still asking. And the person that dismissed me first was a treatment provider.
Mm-hmm.
I would give them an idea and they say, no, that's not going to work. What we need to do is we need to focus A, B, C, D. Mm-hmm. Well, you could have at least entertained it for a few minutes, mm-hmm. right? But because I wasn't a licensed anything, I was just a peer. I was just a mentor. I was just an alumni. And I've heard that said. Mm-hmm. I say this, you're just a judge. You're just a public defender. You're just a district attorney. I would never say that. So in that training thought process, as we get people used to this, understanding that equality of purpose, when we're at the table doing the very best for a participant, individualized one participant at a time.
Mm-hmm. I think both of what you both said really sort of calls to mind, really thinking about how are treatment courts different from other criminal justice processing? So from the very beginning, right, the leaders in the field said, what we're doing isn't working. We need to do something else. And so out of that came the drug court model and then other treatment court models that emerged from that. And one of those hallmark features is this interdisciplinary team and recognizing that an important component of that interdisciplinary team, that voice, is that of peers and folks that have been through the process and have struggled through the struggles. And, that is a perspective that we have to have at the table if we're truly going to embrace this interdisciplinary, team notion that is really the foundation of a treatment court. So really incorporating that into the process. I think you both touched on that. You have mentioned.
Yeah, I think if we're really going to embrace restorative justice, then having someone who's been restored is a very valuable person to have at the table. And again, I don't think that we can reiterate this too much, and that is that it is of equal value to someone with a degree. I have a degree in lived experience. Mm-hmm. I have a degree in trying to stay sober for 30 years, and I finally did it.
Right.
So all of that struggle and all of that, what I call research, right? All of that research, that lived experience pays off. And so that's when I talk about looking through that lens of the peer, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about that person who's been through the restorative process, has been restored, and now can share what that is like. And if you haven't been through that, it's really difficult for you to have an opinion that people who are trying to go through that process will buy into.
Right. Yeah.
And round this up, you know, here's the thing. This is relatively new, integrating peers into this, into staffing, into courts, mm-hmm. into treatment courts. Mm-hmm. And so we have to be patient, considerate, and understanding that you can't expect the court professionals to just consume it because mm-hmm. we said it's time to do it, right?
Right.
These are court professionals that have been doing this for decades.
Right.
We have to make sure they feel comfortable in the training that peers are receiving to come in and serve those courts, also receiving some of that similar training so that they can meet in the middle at that equal place, mm-hmm. right? We can't just expect them to just say, this is what we're doing now, so do it and do it good, right? Of course they want to do it good, but there has to be some change, and we have to transition into that change and make sure that we're thoughtful, mindful as we transition into that change. And we're doing that in New Mexico right now. Before we fully engage in the peer integration project, we're doing the training behind it to make sure people have time mm-hmm. to ask those questions and maybe bring up stuff we never thought of. And let's put that out on the table so that people feel heard. Mm-hmm. So just wanted to throw that out too.
Great. And you've mentioned a couple of times the training that peers get within the states. So if someone were interested in learning more about the certification for peers in their state, where might they go for that information?
Well, for New Mexico, we have an agency that certifies the peers in New Mexico, separate from the judiciary. And again, that is the Office of Peer Recovery Engagement in New Mexico, OPRE. They're a division of the Behavioral Health Human Services Department. So it's HSD, BHSD, but you can look them up and you can find them. But they do all the certification, and they're also in charge of developing with the judiciary that forensic credential that attaches to that basic training mm-hmm. of a certified peer support worker. So that's all on their website. And well, the forensic credential is not there yet, but all that other training and that information should be out there in January of 2024, the right. whole entire program that we're working collaboratively with them as the judiciary.
Excellent.
Yeah, in Alaska, it's our state Alaska Commission for Behavioral Health Certification. So they're the same people that certify state certified chemical dependency counselors.
Okay.
So there's, for us, there's a degree track and a non-degree track, but they also oversee the certification of peers as well.
Okay, great. So we've talked a little bit about the notion of teams having a volunteer position for an alumni or a peer support specialist, and then also opportunities for paid positions, which is great. So I know you both have experience with incorporating these roles on teams and within various states. So can you talk about how teams interested in paying the peer supports, opportunities for doing that?
Go ahead, Michael.
Sure. So in Alaska, so we were in somewhat of a unique position because our alumni was started before the peers were actually incorporated into the court, and our alumni organization was autonomous from the court. So we're not a court-sponsored alumni. We mm-hmm. developed outside of the court, and then we developed a relationship with the court. So we kind of introduced peer support into our courts, and now we have alumni for all of our courts throughout the state. And so we incorporated, and we started with volunteerism. We were willing to volunteer to do things to support participants and things like that. And then what we did was we created a contract with the court. And once we became our own 501c3, and then we were able to get stipends for alumni that were doing specific services for the court. So we we now provide 44 alumni facilitated process groups for every court across the state every month. And they get a stipend for that, for going in and doing that as sort of a subcontract relationship. But then some of the courts in our state also have paid peer support, and they've gotten those through their budgets. And some of that has been through grants. Some of that has been through state allocation and municipal allocation. There's different avenues for that. The organization that helped us formulate, which is a nonprofit organization, they also supplied a peer for the court, I believe, for a little while. And then after some time, we were able to prove to the state what a value our alumni program was. So then we actually were able to get a alumni coordinator position put into the state budget. So now we actually have a line item in the budget that we have been promised will never go away, that organizes all of the services that alumni provide for all the courts across the state. I know also some courts have been able to get grants from BJA and SAMHSA and those resources as well. And then I know that some courts that we've worked with in other states have been very creative in, you know, bake sales and, you know, all kinds of things. They've been very creative and been able to provide for peer support. I know that peer support is big in New Mexico, so I'm going to turn it over to Carlos, see how they fund their peers.
Thanks, Michael. There's a lot of similarities and there are some differences. So in New Mexico, as I said before, we have the Office of Peer Recovery and Engagement, and that agency, that division, is in charge of certifying peers for the whole state, whether it be in the judiciary or in community agencies or whatever that might be. And that's been there for, I think, about a decade now. However, in the judiciary, we did something a little different. So the first thing that we did was we created the New Mexico Treatment Court Standards. And those are endorsed and signed off on by the New Mexico Supreme Court. And in those standards, they're modeled after the national standards, national best practices on how treatment courts have to run and the expectation of how they'll be structured and how they'll run. There is one portion in there about alumni. And when they created that portion, it essentially said, if you decide that you're going to have an alumni engage with participants, they will be required to complete 4 specific trainings given by the administrative office of the courts. They'll get a certificate, not a certification. They'll get a certificate that they've attended these trainings. Then you can move forward and starting an alumni group, a court-sponsored alumni group. Therein came my job. After they did these standards, they realized that, well, as before they got signed off, as they were creating these standards, they realized we need a statewide program manager that's going to actually coordinate all of those efforts. So that's where my position got created. I was blessed to apply and be selected. They were very pointed in the fact that they wanted an alumni to do it, right? Mm-hmm. Back to that value of alumni. If you're going to have someone do it, have someone that has been in the process. And there was a few of us. I was the one that was blessed to be selected. Now, what we do is they're required to take trainings. Those trainings are ethics and boundaries, confidentiality, peer core competencies, modeled after SAMHSA's peer core competencies, and then peer engagement. Those 4 trainings are given by me. I develop the curriculum and I give the trainings once a month, every month to alumni who have graduated or are graduating and are interested in becoming part of the alumni group. But there's also one other thing in those standards. Once you complete those trainings, you have a defined role, and that role is alumni coordinator. That is on a volunteer basis. As I came into the position, I said, this is wonderful. Let's get started. I spent a couple of years getting an alumni group started, going out, sitting with folks, talking to alumni, talking to programs, seeing what the need was, seeing what the interest was, looking at the dynamics. And based on that, I developed a couple of guides. And I developed those guides. And I'm telling all this because this is what bridged the gap between volunteer and paid. So once I developed those guides, I legitimized the role of an alumni coordinator, or hopefully did so. I think I did. And so the idea then became, if we value their lived experience, we should also value their time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we sought out to find funding. Now, we have a moratorium right now in New Mexico on bringing in any federal funds, not in New Mexico, I apologize, in the judiciary of New Mexico. We are not bringing in any federal funding right now. And that's not forever, but right now that was the case. So as I looked for funding, I had to look for it everywhere. But we landed up getting a special appropriation that my leaders have graciously said, hey, let's carve out some of that special appropriation to establish a pay scale for alumni coordinators, folks that are just giving of their time to these programs. But what legitimized it was, one, they've been through the training that's required by the standards. Mm-hmm. Two, they have a legitimate role in the program. And three, they're going to sign a contract with the administrative office of the courts, and we are going to pay them for their time. Four, in order to pay them for their time, their alumni coordinators, those liaisons at those programs, are the ones that will send in the invoices to us for their time. Therefore, we know that the fidelity of the model is being followed. Mm-hmm. So they're actively engaged. They're actively engaging with participants. If they're going to staffing, if they're doing any kind of work, or they're just providing suggestions around responses to behavior, responses to noncompliance, or all those types of things, we're paying them for that time. We pay them an hourly rate. And that hourly rate, you get paid once a month. That is contractor work. We recognize, based on that hourly rate, you're going to have to pay taxes on that at the end of the year. So we took an aggregate total of professionals working in those same roles across the state, both in and out of the court system, found an aggregate number that everybody could agree on, and that's the hourly rate we pay them. The hope is one, they feel valued. Two, they see their role expanding and they decide to become certified peer support workers, or they decide to become therapists. So we increase the resource in the recovery community. Mm-hmm. With people with lived experience. We have been able in New Mexico we have 58 active programs, treatment court programs. We're just at 24 active alumni groups in a little under 2 years. That are started up, in process, already running. We've got all that going. We have one program in New Mexico in Eddy County, the 5th Judicial District. That alumni group has been going for 6 years.
Wow.
It started 6 years ago on its own. They actually helped us to develop some of the model that we're using. They have an alumni group every week. They have 10 to 12 alumni that support it. All of those alumni have taken the training, become alumni coordinators. The last thing I'm going to say is this, and it goes back to what we talked about earlier. As part of the standards, your liaison, whether it be your treatment court coordinator, your surveillance officer, your probation officer, whoever it is in the court that is in charge of the alumni program, is required to take the trainings as well. And the reason for that is so that you know, as a liaison from that alumni coordinator to the court, you know what they've been trained on. So you can speak to the safety of the process for the participants. You can speak to the legitimacy of the paid position. It's important that we really find a way to pay our alumni that are engaged, but also, we've now created this process to integrate the peers, certified peers, into the programs, into the courts. And so that is also through a special appropriation in creating actual job tools in our judiciary to create solid permanent positions, not term positions, permanent positions for peers to serve our courts.
That's great.
I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the things that Carlos had said that were pertinent for our experience in Alaska, and that is that the only paid position that we have in our alumni in our 501c3 is the state coordinator position, which is paid by the state. It's actually not paid by the alumni, it's paid by the state, and then those facilitator stipends. So all of our alumni, we provide other services. We have a bunch of different meetings and groups that alumni can attend and participants can attend that are not required by the court. Those process groups are required by the court. So none of our, even our facilitators, one of the differences between possibly a paid peer and an alumni that gets a stipend is that they don't have any access to records. They don't attend the staffings or the pre-meets. They don't provide information to the court or a non-reporting agency. All we report is attendance. So if someone shows up to the process group or not, that's the only thing that we report. And as we developed this relationship with the court, we recognized, and before we started these facilitating these groups, the needs for trainings and creating safe spaces and building legitimacy and credibility with the court. So we also started having all of our alumni attend trainings. They have to attend. They don't have to become peers, the certified peers, but before you can facilitate, you have to take the 40-hour training. Okay. That certified peers would have to take. You also have to take ethics and confidentiality and CPR and first aid. So we recognize the need, even though we're volunteer for the most part, except for those stipends, that we needed to create that safe space. And we also needed to build the legitimacy mm-hmm. of our relationship with the court so that they would refer folks to us. We've been in operation since 2006, and we have a really wonderful relationship with all of our courts. And so, but because as we've evolved, we've been conscientious about these things, I think is why we've maintained our credibility and have done so well. Mm-hmm. We also have had very few incidences in terms of any negative experiences participants have had with any of the services that alumni have provided, because we have focused so much on training, understanding. And then, of course, everybody who does that has been through the court and has a desire for those people to succeed. So building those relationships are very important. Another difference between the paid and the volunteer, again, is that the court doesn't direct any of our staff. Mm-hmm. They don't ask anything of our staff. They don't ask us to fulfill any, like, they're not going to ask a court facilitator to transport participants or mm-hmm. anything like that. Where a peer is an employee, and mm-hmm. so therefore they may provide many different services to the court, depending on whatever their role is in their contract and so on and so forth. So a big difference between that is not only the responsibilities and the regulations, and if you're a certified peer, then you have a code of ethics that you have to abide by, as well as the code of ethics of your court and whatever certifications and licensures that you may have, where volunteers don't really have that, right? Although anybody that's involved in our organization, we do have our own set of ethics that we ask them to follow.
Mm-hmm. So, Michael and Carlos, I can imagine that peer support specialists or alumni that are interacting with participants can carry some heavy loads, let's say, from the experiences that they've experienced themselves through trauma and trying to maintain their recovery, as well as the experiences of those that they are working with. Can you talk a little bit about the concept of self-care and how that relates to peer support, recovery specialist, or alumni? And, you know, how does that interact, I suppose, with these positions?
Absolutely. One of the things that we focus on in training our alumni for our organization, or if we're providing the peer support certification training, is that rule number one is that your job cannot be your recovery. Mm-hmm. You have to have your recovery has to be standalone outside of your job. Mm-hmm. Your job is not your recovery and will not keep you sober. That's the number one thing. The other is that because you have lived experience, you have your own trauma, you have your own triggers, you have things that you must watch out for. And so you need to maintain a healthy recovery, which is something for our alumni. Some people can feel we can be a little bit intrusive in that and making sure that people are maintaining their recovery. But it's for their own benefit, because we want people to make sure that they're taking care of themselves so that they can bring their best selves to the work that they do, but also so that they maintain their long-term sobriety and their path to wellness. And we provide support for all of our alumni workers. We have support meetings that are just for our facilitators, where they can come and have a space where they can talk about the struggles that they may have in dealing with secondary trauma, and burnout and all those things. And we also provide opportunities for sober activities just for our facilitators and our boards to have healthy activities to support them in ways that they can process those things that they experienced, because we don't want that. If the last thing we would want is for them to return to use or suffer any self-destructive behavior as a result of providing care for other people. Mm-hmm. So we put a lot of that in place, and we promote it a great deal. A big part of our 40-hour training is focused on that for peers and alumni. And when I can say that for us, we're very fortunate that the culture that we have in our alumni is if somebody doesn't hear from you or see from you in a very short period of time, we come and find you, right? We come and find you and make sure that you're okay, mm-hmm. right? And so it's a big focus, because I think we have more things at stake in terms of the workforce that we provide has more potholes and pitfalls for us than for people who don't have that lived experience.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Some of the stuff I'm doing is aspirational, so I want to give full disclosure. I've learned a lot of what I'm doing right now from Alaska and from Michael and his colleague and my colleague Ron Wilson and Carlos Diaz. You know, these are individuals and Doreen. I don't want to say her name wrong. Do you want to help me out there, Michael?
Schenkenberger.
I always say it wrong, and I've known her for years. But those are all individuals, my mentors, that have helped me to really understand and comprehend what needs to happen, especially in New Mexico, because we are court-sponsored right now. That aspirational part one is those court-sponsored groups will become independent and become autonomous of the court program, right, at one point. But one of the things that's aspirational as well is finding that safe space where we can network together as alumni, because the bottom line here is we lead by example as alumni and as peers, no matter what we're recovering from. If whatever we're in recovery from, mental health, substance use disorder, whatever that is, we lead by example. How we live in our recovery is how we give a message of hope to those that we're serving. And so that's my message when I'm training alumni, mm-hmm. is that your recovery comes first. Do not compromise your recovery for any reason, because what you bring to the table is your recovery and your lived experience. So be mindful, be honest, and know that it's a safe space to say, hey, I'm at a place where I got to step away for a little bit and I need some support. Mm-hmm. So I train the alumni to know that. I train them as groups. I train the liaisons from the programs to understand, hey, if your alumni tells you they need to step away, they need to step away. Let them step away. Right. We'll find someone to fill in. We have alumni across the state. We can do virtual meetings for a while and have someone else facilitate. But here's what I want you all to know. I'm a one-man show here in New Mexico. So the aspirational part is to create another position. I hope my boss is listening right now. is to create another position to support this work, mm-hmm. because we need to have continued support for all of our alumni coordinators, okay. and for those peers who are going to integrate into the court programs and have a safe space for them to decompress, because we do carry a lot. Mm-hmm. We carry a lot of what we hear, and we carry it because we can't share it. So we want to help folks. Sometimes we can't, but we take that with us. But it's really important to create a network. And so what I do in New Mexico as a one-man show, and Michael will tell you, I'm extremely busy. And what that means is I concentrate and focus on all of those groups that have started and those alumni coordinators that are running those groups. I try and meet with them every 2 weeks. And I give them a safe space to tell me how I can support them, how the court can support them, what are the things that are working well, let's celebrate success. But here's the other thing. I also give them a safe space to tell me we need more help in this area of training. And so we create professional development around that consensus. It's important to support each other as people in recovery. And we need to know that it's okay to say it's too much. Right. And so I really push that messaging. But as a one-man show, I do my very best to meet with everybody. What also happens is I also encourage these groups to do the two-prong process, is what I call it. You're creating a strategy to meet with participants. You also need to create a strategy to meet with each other, mm-hmm. right? So the alumni group is not just a group of alumni to help participants. It's to help each other. Mm-hmm. So you create your own support network right there where you can get together, talk about things, and then either come to me or go to your liaison. I'm often invited to go meet with the alumni groups, just the alumni of these different court programs. They'll invite me to come, and more times than not, the reason they asked me to come was because there's a problem, or there's something really big to celebrate and they don't know how to convey that to the program. And so we work together to do that. So aspirational. I'd love to be as big as Alaska in terms of being able to have, facilitated groups for my alumni coordinators. Mm-hmm. I don't have that right now, but I know they're supporting each other. I know I'm doing my best to support them. But we teach that self-care, that it, no matter what, if anything you've learned in your recovery is you have to put your recovery first. Right. You put your recovery first and everything else comes right following with it. Mm-hmm. If you don't, nothing else follows with it. And then ultimately bad things start happening. So we also encourage folks, if they return to use and they get back on the right track, to come back and share that. Because that's important to hear the old adage of 7 times down, 8 times up. Mm-hmm. We have to know that if we return to use, it is possible for us to get back into the right space. And so those are valuable too. Mm-hmm. Last thing I'm going to tell you is this. Everybody has a lived experience, including the people in the court program. So we learn to respect all lived experience and how we learn to get better and more focused on our own recovery path by being open to listening to that and allowing for safe space for that as well.
Yeah. All of what you said really, I think, speaks to the importance of, having training for the peer support, the peer workers, the importance of training for teams, right, to understand that role and how the boundaries and how to incorporate that effectively onto the team, providing the peer support workers with support while they're doing the work with participants, but then also providing structure and support for them as individuals, as professionals working with teams. And so all of that, I think, really just reminds me that building the infrastructure for peer support is really important to making that the most effective role it can be. Not just, kind of implementing this and saying, okay, good luck, but rather providing the training and the support that's needed, both professionally, but also personally. So thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. As a substance use counselor, one of the things that was drummed into me is that if you're going to be providing counseling, you should be in counseling. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we can relate that to the professional realm, right, where those people need their support as well, right? And I know that there's organizations that support attorneys and judges, and they have peers that they meet with and that mm-hmm. they associate with and that they lean on. Right. And so why would it be any different for peers?
Exactly.
That's 100% the truth, Michael. When I became a counselor, when I started to become a counselor 13 years ago, the counselor that was my mentor was my counselor in treatment court, drug court at the time, that's what it was called. And he told me rule number one, get yourself a therapist. Mm-hmm. And I told him, but I'm in recovery. I'm sober. Why do I need a therapist? He said, I don't want you to find out why. Just start seeing therapists. Set up a regular time to meet with a therapist, because as you meet with clients, you'll see why.
Right.
Don't wait till it's too late. And he was also a person in recovery. Mm-hmm. So I listened to him. I said, well, he's a person in recovery, so I should probably listen. Best move I ever made, because what I didn't realize is, had I not had a safe space for self-care, I would have kept all that on me,
right,
and my shoulders wouldn't have carried the weight after a while. Mm-hmm. And worst case scenario, that was going to come out with the participants I'm trying to serve. Mm-hmm. And so as I became a certified peer support worker a little while back, I realized, just as Michael said, how's that any different?
Exactly.
That's not any different. And how can that be any different for an alumni coordinator here in New Mexico? How could that be any different? You're sitting in a group, allowing people in a self-help / mutual aid group, mm-hmm. where you're allowing people to relieve themselves of burdens. Well, if those burdens don't go anywhere, they go with you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you have to process through that through self-care. And that's self-care for them. Mm-hmm. Total wellness is a huge dynamic we need to really push in all these professions, specifically for alumni coordinators, peers, certified peers. We really need to consider what total wellness looks like for folks, so that we start helping folks develop a total wellness regimen. I know that I've been working on my own, and it's a development in process. It's never going to stop, mm-hmm. but I'm mindful of it. I'm not going to say I'm perfect at it. I'm mindful of it, so that I know when I need to do some work, I do some work. Perfect example is I've been with Michael on a couple of trips now, where me and Michael we start talking, and he's my therapist. Yeah, I'm just, there's things that I need to be mindful of, and they come up and we talk through them as peers, and I get to a better place. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm serving the next person, mm-hmm. I'm coming from a better place because Michael was there for me, or I was there for Mike. So I just want to put that out there, and I always thank you, Michael, because you know what I'm talking about.
Great.
Well, yeah, because you provided it for me as well. And thank you too, sir.
Nice. Beautiful.
So you both are board members of the National Treatment Court Alumni Association, which is amazing. So we would like for you to give us a few snippets of what the organization is all about, and for those interested, where they might go for some additional information.
Well, thank you. I'm going to let Michael start, because Michael is the historian and an executive board member of our organization. And he was the one with the mindset to get this started back in 2006. So Michael, this is your opportunity.
Well, I appreciate that. I was going to let you do it as the chair of our organization, but thank you very much, Carlos. I appreciate the opportunity to share, because I'm just so excited. And what Carlos is talking about is, once we started an alumni in Alaska, I was very fortunate to attend a National Association of Drug Court Professionals conference, and I saw that there was one or two other alumni representatives there from other courts around the state. And I just thought, wow, we really need a national organization. And I started talking with NADCP at the time. And at the time, they weren't ready to really support that. But I just kind of made a declaration to myself and to NADCP in the world that, we will see one. We will see one, and we'll see it in my lifetime. And I didn't realize how prophetic that was until just recently. But in 2016, NADCP, now known as All Rise, saw the value in alumni coming together. And so they did some focus groups to see how alumni could come together. They didn't really have the vision of a National Alumni Association necessarily, but they knew that alumni had something to offer and that they were valuable and that they were wanting to provide, because many of these conversations had already happened. And so even though a national association wasn't the product of those focus groups, the people that attended those focus groups continued to stay connected to each other and have those conversations. And then in at one of the NADCP conferences, enough of them got together to say, hey, let's just get together and start talking about how we can support each other. And so that happened. And we got together and we kind of called ourselves a think tank at the time. And there was just people. And we had people from Maine to Alaska and the many states in between. And we still do. They got together on a regular basis. And we decided that what we really needed was a National Alumni Association. And we had the idea to be a support for therapeutic courts across the country. And so our mission, and I know that we talked about wanting to share this, and I'm really glad, because our mission is to support alumni group development and sustainability to meet the needs for extended recovery support for all treatment court graduates nationwide. So one of our goals and vision is to bring peer support through alumni to all treatment courts to ensure that they have robust alumni groups to support the critical needs of those they serve. And we're really dedicated. Carlos is amazing in his tireless dedication to this. We have a group of people on our executive board and our board, our overall board, that really are just tirelessly and voluntarily giving of our time to make this happen. And we've been very fortunate to incorporate as of last year. We incorporated and became the National Treatment Court Alumni Association. And we sort of came out at the 2022 NADCP conference and shared with the court community that we existed and that we were working on becoming a support for them. And we've been able to field some support requests from them, the ones that we could, and we're doing more and more as time goes on. Last year, we were able to just phenomenal relationship with All Rise, and now we've been able to sign a memorandum of understanding with them, and we've been able to provide trainings for court. Carlos and I were honored to be one of the first pair to go to, we went to Scranton, Ohio, and began teaching treatment courts how to start alumni programs. Mm-hmm. And so we're just really excited that we're actually getting off the ground. Our goal is to become our own 501c3 eventually, and continue that relationship with All Rise so that we can meet the desires of our mission and our vision. And so we just have a wonderful group of people, fantastic, just wonderful group of people. It's had to be divine inspiration for sure to get the group of people that we have together with the skills and enthusiasm and drive and desire to do the work that we do. Did I forget anything, Carlos?
No, but I will tell you, we did our inaugural training technical assistance through All Rise, Michael and I, in Scranton, Pennsylvania, not Ohio. Yeah, it was amazing. That's okay, Michael. I just want to give a little more information because we're excited about this, right? So I was blessed to be elected as the chair for this organization. I just want to say this organization started out, as Michael said, as a think tank, but I need you all to understand this was a group of graduates from programs, as Michael said, from coast to coast, from tip to tip of the United States across four time zones. We put in thousands of volunteer hours to put this together. in meeting virtually and getting things together, developing tons of documentation. We did apply for a 501c3. This month, we should get assigned to an individual at the IRS. That's the process, and start moving towards that. But I want to make sure that we also highlight that NADCP at the time, Now All Rise, they came in and supported us. They backed us right from the beginning and said, whatever you guys want to do, we're behind you. And so we went and did it. Mm-hmm. We had faith that they were going to back us, and they did. And the growth in just the last couple of years is unbelievable. You know, as Michael mentioned, at Rise 22, I think we had Michael, we had five sessions at Rise 22. No, I had four sessions at Rise 22. At Rise 23, we had six sessions, and now coming up for Rise 24, seven sessions. And now at Rise 24, we'll probably have seven or more. Great. And these are sessions geared towards both alumni and to professionals in the mm-hmm. field who want to learn more about alumni and alumni development. And it's just a blessing that we can share all this. We, as a group of professionals in all different levels of profession in the treatment court modalities, as certified peers, as clinicians, as alumni, we're all over the place. And we bring all that expertise. But the one thing that I want to make sure you know is we harp on self-care, right? What I mean by that is we harp on each other to make sure that everybody's taking care of themselves and not forgetting family and not forgetting recovery and all those things, because we are dedicated. We put in thousands of hours. And that memorandum of understanding we signed with All Rise at Rise 23, that set the stage for this collaborative effort, where now we are working on a toolkit that will be released by All Rise in early 2024 that will help programs to understand what they need, the basics they need to start an alumni or alumni following the alumni program. And then All Rise will connect them with us as NTCAA, National Treatment Court Alumni Association, and we'll start providing that technical assistance on a regular basis. On top of that toolkit, we're also developing training modules that will also be released in early 2024 that will coincide with that toolkit, so that we've built a stepping stone for each part of the process in starting alumni groups and building alumni groups in treatment courts across the nation. And we have just been honored to be a part of that. Now, I got to tell you, you know, right now we operate on guts and power. That's just what it is. And we shoot for the moon. When we've asked All Rise, even when they were formerly NADCP, and we've asked them, here's what we'd like to have, the answer was never no. The answer was, we'll try and find it. And what we can find, we're going to provide you. It has become bigger and bigger. And this year, we see bigger things happening. And the main reason that we want to mention that is it's not just the National Treatment Court Alumni Association that's doing this. It's All Rise coming in and saying, this movement is happening and needs to happen, and have more emphasis put on alumni and peers and their integration into the court systems and the treatment court systems and those processes. And so they're partnering with us and others to make sure that happens. So we're just proud and honored to be a part of that.
That's awesome.
That is.
I just like to add that we, in the last year, we have increased our membership to 130, I believe it is now, to 130.
131.
That's awesome. I don't want to forget that one, because it's just as important as all the rest of them. Yeah. So prior to Rise 2023, I think we're right around 40, right? We were right around 40 somewhere, give or take. But then after Rise 23, yeah, to this date, we're now up to 131. Thank you, Carlos, for that. I also want to let people know that we do have an opportunity for them to communicate with us. We cannot fulfill every request, but the ones that we can, we do. If you would like, if it's okay with you, I'd like to provide an email address. You can send it to us at info at ntcaa.net. And I will do my best to send those emails to the people that can fulfill those requests the best, or at least let you know why we can't fill that request at this time, if that's what it is. But please don't hesitate to send us a request, because if we can fill it, we will.
And you can also follow us on Facebook. We do have a Facebook page, and you'll find us as National Treatment Corps Alumni Association. It's all recovery centered. You're welcome to follow us on Facebook. We also have an Instagram. Michael, I don't know nothing about Instagram. You guys already know that. So however you get to the Instagram, probably through Facebook, not my deal, but we are on Instagram. We are building a website. We're in the process of getting that started. It'll take us some time. Just as people are looking for funding to integrate peers into their programs, we're looking for funding as well. But until we get the 501c3, we're just in the planning stages to make sure we're prepared so that when that funding comes in, we can kick that off. We are not a lazy bunch, that I will tell you. we are a motivated, passionate group of people. And I want everybody out there listening to know that if you have alumni in your state, in your county, in your region that you think would be interested in this, reach out to us on Facebook. Have them reach out to us on Facebook, because they can join the organization from Facebook. There is a QR code or a link in there that it'll show you if you want to become a member. It's a very simple application. It doesn't cost anything. We're not charging. Ask some very simple demographic questions, because we do recognize we need to gather data. We also want to know what people's strengths are, so we know what to invite them into being a part of, if it's something that they have a strength with or a passion with. So there is all that opportunity.
That's wonderful. And for our listeners, we will link to their Facebook page and some of that other information. You'll be able to find that at the bottom of the podcast. So that's fantastic.
So Carlos and Michael, one of the features of our podcast, Justice to Healing, is this idea of a call to action. So we really see the podcast as a vehicle for folks to gather information about a topic. And then the hope is that they will take this back to their programs, to their jurisdictions, and actually put the information into practice. So what would you like our listeners to take away from today's episode?
A couple of things. One is that please recognize the value of those who are going through your court. They have skills and enthusiasm and energy and lived experience that can benefit your participants in your court, and also incorporate peer workers into your court. If nothing else, a healthy alumni engagement with your program will increase the success rate of your participants. You will lose fewer participants. You'll have a higher completion rate. The quality of their recovery and the length of their recovery will be extended. And also your court programs will benefit if you listen to those who have gone through your program to continually update and upgrade and improve your programs so that you can continue to increase the quality of the care that your participants receive. That's really the main benefit of peers and alumni, especially, is that someone that goes through your program can help you improve the program itself. The other is that, again, recognize the specific role that peers have. Please, if you're going to have peers in your program, let them be peers. You're really going to rob yourself of the value if you don't. If you turn them into case managers or something other than peers, then you're going to lose the value that they bring to your programs. And know that whether they're a certified peer support or if they're an alumni that's volunteering their time, they too need to that self-care component, right? Mm-hmm. Again, you talked about it. You did a really good job of talking about you need to create training and understanding of what that role is, both on the peer side and the court side, to support those roles so that you can maximize it, and also that you won't create a situation that burns them out or creates a harmful situation for those people that you're using in your programs. And I think that's what I got.
Well, for me, I want to just really talk about what you call this series, and that's justice to healing. When we heal, we need to find a way to heal, because you don't start healing until you start doing something about it, until you start actively seeking ways to heal, no matter what the ailment, no matter what the illness. When we're talking about this type of restorative justice, the whole point really is just start something. Start something, do something, get something started. If all that means is right now you have alumni, you don't have funding, you don't have a process, you don't have training, get your alumni together and ask them to come and support you and your participants in getting better. Just start something. You will be amazed at what happens when you bring those folks together. And when you bring them together and you're asking for their help, you're not bringing them together to tell them to do something. You're asking them what to do. That's the big difference. So just start something and never give up. Keep trying. Keep asking for funding. Get somebody to sponsor a bill to get you some money. Get some alumni together to go speak to those legislators. Get the ball rolling. Nothing moves that pen on the signature line than real life experience that your alumni or your peers can provide. Use the resource. It's there, and the people are more than willing to help. And just start somewhere. Somewhere. Reach out. Reach out to some folks that you know of that just graduated, 5 years ago. Reach out. Just send some emails out. You may not get all the responses. You may not get very good responses, but you're going to get some. And you only need one to start with one, and you build from there. I also want you to really consider the empowerment this process brings. The empowerment it brings to your alumni, to your peers, the empowerment it brings to your participants, and the empowerment it brings to you as a professional in the role that you play. When you put all those things together, the result is success. Seek training and develop processes. Please. There's tons of training out there. All Rise has training. SAMHSA has training. BJA has training. And BJA and SAMHSA, they have funding. They have funding for peer initiatives. Seek out those funding opportunities to start building something. Be prepared to write a grant and support that grant. Sit down with your alumni or your peers and ask them, here's the grant we're going for. What does this look like? Again, when you bring them to the table, when you bring us to the table, you will be amazed at what we have to offer. And we'll be willing to do what it takes to get something started. Lastly, I want to say this to you. I said at the beginning of this podcast, and I'm going to say it again. I sit here in front of you talking to you almost 23 years in recovery. And when I started this journey, I was going to prison for 18 and a half years, and I didn't care if I lived or died. And the only reason I sit here is because alumni came to me and empowered me to find change. And they did that by showing me the change they made. Just start something.
Great. So Carlos and Michael, we would just like to thank you so much for joining us today. This was really incredibly rich conversation. I learned a lot. I know our listeners did as well. And we appreciate your willingness to share both your knowledge and experience throughout this process. So thank you. To our listeners, thank you for being here. Please join us next time for another episode of Justice to Healing. And always remember to do better.
To our listeners, we thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. Be sure to hit subscribe to stay updated on the podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn to stay engaged with us, and check out our website at ndcrc.org. Thanks again. Catch you next time on Justice to Healing. The Justice to Healing podcast is presented by the National Drug Court Resource Center and was supported by the grant number 2019 DCBXK002, awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance, which also includes the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the National Institute of Justice, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, the Office for Victims of Crime, and the Smart Office. Points of view or opinions in this podcast are those of the author and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the United States Department of Justice.